Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otto. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. We've been talking to leaders about how their diverse identities inform how they work and how they lead. But good intentions are not enough. Many of the inherent problems leaders from diverse backgrounds and identities face are systemic, and this usually means money, how they are paid, and how they are awarded. Sometimes we need to get technical, and that's why I wanted today's guest on the podcast. Anita Letting is one of the top 100 HR Tech influencers for 2025. She's written three books, one on choosing your next payroll, one on pay transparency, as well as an upcoming book for new leaders on understanding your payslip. Anita is the founder of HR Tech Radar and a leading authority on the future of work, pay innovation, HR transformation, and outsourcing. She has over 25 years' experience in the HR and payroll industries. She is also a board member, renowned public speaker, and a LinkedIn top voice. Anita says, "If you're truly serious about empowering women, it's simple. Put them in positions of power. And the best way to do that, give them economic power by paying them fairly and equally. We're not asking to be celebrated one day a year. We're not asking for more. We're just asking for equal treatment." Anita Letting, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Thank you, Charlotte. I'm so happy to be here today.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So Anita, in Europe, we're still way behind with gender pay equity. I think on average, women are paid 12% less than men doing the same jobs. But we are making some headway with pay transparency. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. And it is unfortunate, but the way that we're going to make headway is through legislation. I think that what we've seen over the past decade is that the pay gap is slowly closing, but it's so slow that if we continue on this trajectory, we will not see equal pay for men and women until the 2050s, the 2060s, which means our great grandchildren. That sounds like a horrible future. So the Pay Transparency Directive that is currently in effect mandates that companies of a certain size report once a year on the gender pay gap, and that pay gap cannot exceed 5%.
Interesting. And how are countries and companies responding to that?
I have seen very different takes. As you can imagine, some companies are already ahead of the curve, especially a number of very large international companies that take social responsibility very seriously. So for them, it's not a big deal. They already run these reports and they know exactly where they are. I think where we see some hesitation and a lot of doubts and sometimes even a little bit of pushback is in the mid-sized companies, because obviously for them, it will be an additional report. It will be an additional investigation, probably reparation as well. And What I see now more and more is sounds like, well, this is all administration and it's more administration instead of less, and how does it help us? And of course, when you just look at it through the lens of administration and process, yes, this is more work. But when you look at it through the lens of equality, then it's something that you should have done years ago. So I always say, what are you waiting for?
Yeah. And it's a pay transparency directive. Mm-hmm. At what point are companies going to be forced to run those reports and equalize?
So what it means, what the directive means is that it's an EU directive with the intent that every company needs to transpose, every country needs to transpose this into national law. So countries have until June of 2026 to do that. And then the first report for every company, no matter where you are based in Europe, is June of 2027.
Okay, great. And I understand that there's a unique twist in the Dutch law where you live in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a special, unique Dutch-related twist. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what the Dutch have done is, I think, very smart. Instead of crafting a new law, they have amended three existing laws. And that means that the process for companies to go through all of this is a lot easier than if it were a complete new law. Secondly, they have included the works councils. They've given them an actual role, which is also smart. And then thirdly, they are extending it to temp labor as well. So if you hire people into your company from an external source, these employees fall under your gender pay gap, which means that you as a company have to make sure that you pay them equally for equal work compared to your permanent employees. And of course, that is what it's all about.
Wow. I mean, that really feels like systemic change to me. So congrats to the Dutch.
Yeah. Let's see how, because it is a consultation at the moment. People obviously have sent letters about how they perceive these changes. So let's see what remains in the end. But the fact that the change comes through these three laws will not change.
That's so interesting. Anita, are there any myths about the pay gap that you'd like to bust?
There are a lot of myths about the pay gap. And in my book, I have devoted a full chapter to the various myths that exist. One of the most interesting myths, also one of the most pervasive ones, is that, you know, there's a pay gap simply because women negotiate not as much as men, or they are not as good in negotiation as men. And when I started to look into that, I quickly found research that actually says, hold on, that is not the case. What is important is the person that sits across the table. And what research has discovered is that when men apply for a job and they're in this conversation and they start to negotiate, then the hiring manager is much more inclined to go along with that negotiation than when the person across the table is a woman. And what I found super interesting is that it does not matter if the hiring manager is a man or a woman. The inclination to start negotiating with men is simply higher than women. And the researchers do not offer an explanation for that. But this was one of the most interesting research studies that I read during the research for my book.
So does that mean that women's attempt to negotiate are shut down quicker?
Yes, because what the researchers were looking for is, first of all, do women start this negotiation and how often? And what they found is that women start this negotiation just as often as men do. but hiring managers just shut them down.
That's really interesting. So the way to negotiate is more generous for men than it is for women.
Or maybe more expected. The study really doesn't go into that detail, but it was one of the most interesting findings that I read, simply because we all take for granted that men are better negotiators, that they always negotiate, that they more often negotiate, and that is simply not the case.
So interesting, Anita. Now, I know that you are often in a position to advise graduates and new leaders. How do you advise them now with that knowledge to advocate for themselves in pay negotiations?
What I typically say to them is you need to be really prepared. Lots of people go into pay negotiations and they have an idea of what they want, but they're not really firm about it. And when I talk to them, I first of all try to help them to establish a range. I mean, don't pin yourself on one number. Establish a range that you have a little bit of leeway. Then do not only think in money, also think in terms of benefits and pensions and maybe stock options or anything that you can add, because it represents money. And sometimes companies are more willing to flex on the benefits than on the salary. And then thirdly, also establish for yourself your walkaway number. At one point will you say, sorry, this is below my expectations, or if we cannot agree on these two things, then I will not sign. If you have thought about these three things prior to the conversation, then that conversation will be better for you because of that preparation, because you know your limits, because you know what you want. And I have the feeling that, first of all, many people don't know what they can ask for. That's where it starts. And then secondly, even if they know what they can ask for, they don't make a choice for themselves what the minimum is that they want to walk away with.
That's such brilliant advice. And that first salary negotiation, it's so contested because that first number that you paid defines your pay for the rest of your life, including your pension. And yet it's the point in your career where you're the most vulnerable, the least sure, the most insecure, the most nervous, and yet it's the most critical negotiation you're probably ever going to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if I think back to when I started to negotiate my salaries, I had no idea what was common for that job. And we did not have pay transparency yet. You could not look up salary databases on the internet or, you know, a public benchmark or something like that. So you were really in the dark about what you could ask for. Obviously, you had not yet spoken to any of your colleagues, so you had no idea what they were getting. And you walk into the job, and then maybe 2-3 months later, you find out that someone has more vacation days than you, or more salary, or whatever. I think these days, it's a lot easier for people to prepare themselves. First of all, a lot of vacancies now show some salary indication, a band or something like that. But then also, employees have banded together and have created these huge spreadsheets that you can find on the internet where they put in everything about their role, responsibilities, salary, benefits, and so on and so forth. So it is much easier today to get an idea of, you know, ballpark where you should be or what you should ask for. And then, of course, in Europe, with the Pay Transparency Directive, it will now be the other way around. So before your first interview, the employer will need to disclose to you what the salary band is, what, you know, what the benefits are, what total compensation is. they are not mandated per se by the directive to do that in the ad. It's okay if they send you an email with the offer, but they have to disclose it before you engage in that important conversation.
That's super interesting. And for me, that takes the emotion out of it. And it takes the kind of, certainly in my generation, the kind of social embarrassment about talking about money mm-hmm. completely off the table, which is so healthy.
Yeah. And there's another big change with this, is that an employer is not allowed to ask about your salary history. So when we started this conversation and you mentioned that, you know, that first salary is so important because it determines what you earn for the rest of your life, that goes away to some extent, simply because, you know, the habit of asking for your salary slip, can you show me a salary slip? You cannot do that anymore. When an employer asks, what do you have in mind? You don't have to answer that. You don't have to answer that today, but it's a really difficult thing to do. And so this whole equal pay for equal work will now much more be determined on what an employer offers instead of what an employee can ask for.
That's so interesting. It's really shifting the balance mm-hmm. of power.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about talking to you, Anita, is that you always have strong opinions backed up by strong data. And I know that you're thinking and writing a lot at the moment about AI and particularly how AI relates to HR. Mm-hmm. What are three things you would really like HR leaders to know about AI?
The first thing I would say is don't be afraid, because this is coming, this is here, and you cannot ignore it. And assuming that this will all go away and that there will be some crash and stuff, no. The second thing that I would say is you are in charge, and make sure that you are in charge, because it's real easy to sort of let yourself be guided, let yourself be managed, and then you go from one solution to the other, you go from one thought leader to the other, and they're all like, yeah, this is great, you should do this. And you don't have to do anything. You are in charge of whatever AI will bring you. And then thirdly, have a great program around how AI in your company is ethical and secure. And especially for the CHRO, as we are dealing with people, we need to make sure that we are not exposing private data, personal identifiable information to external actors. So it's up to us to really make sure that when we engage with AI vendors, when we start to use AI solutions, we are 100% sure that there are no adverse effects to our people, to our future employees, but also to the company, because this can bring you down.
Yeah, those are three great tips. So it's don't be afraid, you're in control, and protect your data. And I would say, speaking as a former comms person, that those three are also valid for communications, except with comms, yep. I'd say just make sure you're protecting your confidentiality. So Anita, you're a leader with decades of experience. You've sat on management boards, and now you're a non-executive board director. And you recently said that we haven't cracked the code on effective leadership. You said we don't know where to find them or how to develop them, and that we promote people to leadership roles and hope they'll just figure it out. Could you talk about the challenges as you see them and how we could redesign leadership?
Yeah, this was actually based on some research that I did around employee engagement and why the numbers go down instead of up. With all the efforts that we did, you know, that we put in place during the pandemic, the programs, the measures, everything that we could throw at employee engagement, we did, and it hasn't really moved the needle. And through the research that I did, I started to understand that a large part of that is attributable to the relationship that you have with your manager. And when I started to look into that, there was this very interesting finding that came from Gartner, actually, where they claimed that, you know, managers are cracking under pressure. And they had this lovely image that came along with that, and that showed how, you know, the top level is pushing down on managers, asking them to deliver more and more and more and be more productive. And at the same time, employees are looking at managers wanting to have a good relationship, wanting to have attention, wanting to have mentorship. And we have not really decided what we want these middle managers to be. Are they now the guardians of productivity? Are they the ones that need to lead engagement? Are they the ones that need to drive business results? Or are they all of that? And at the moment, they're all of that. And when you then realize that very often managers are promoted because they are the best of the team, that does not necessarily mean that they are the best in leading people. It's just they're the expert, and then we promote them into a managerial role. And we just assume that they continue as normal and now lead the team. But what we really need to do is look at managers as a very specific profession that we equip these people for, that we train them for, but that we also constantly mentor and guide them in. And when we can move to that last part, then I think we can flip the switch. But as long as we keep expecting that the best expert is also the best team leader, we're stuck. It simply does not work. And the interesting thing about this is that we have known this for what? 25, 30 years? For as long as middle managers existed. And we have not really done something about it, because we all seem to think that, yeah, if you're a manager, yeah, we are not paying you just to be a manager, because that's too expensive. You need to also deliver something or do something or run a project or whatever. Where in fact, if you as a manager, as a leader, can make your people be 2 times more productive, you've already earned your salary.
Yeah, what's coming up for me is a sort of image of the sandwich generation, which people also describe parenting, where you're stuck between the elder generation and the children, and the pressure is growing and growing. But it also makes me think that how to develop those effective middle managers. You know, there's so many university programs, and I know you advise a university. Mm-hmm. I've done executive education, but they're so uneven. There's not a standardization of what manager training should look like.
No, and the other thing is that it is often an elective. It's not like you become a manager and then your company says, oh, wait, you're a manager now. Here's this course. This is what we do. Or even before you become a manager. And sometimes you have these courses that people go through, but it's not really the right thing to equip you for what happens the day you become a manager. And I think unless we really start to create this track where we say, this is the manager track. If you follow all of this, then after 2 years or so, yes, we can promote you to become a leader. And I know that there are companies that do that. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like universally we don't deliver good managers. But for an average company, for a mid-sized company, this is a huge investment. And they don't know if once that person has gone through all that education and piloting, if they are actually going to stay for a long time. So
I can see how sometimes the time and the cost investment can be prohibitive. But I think, especially now, with all the technology coming, with the changes that companies have to go through to apply all of that in a good way, we really need to understand what makes good managers, and we need to actively educate and guide them to become good managers and potentially future leaders.
Yeah, I'm getting stress memories as you were talking of when I was promoted into a manager role.
Mm.
And there were education courses, but I was so busy delivering on my own deliverables and managing my team's productivity. I mean, for the first 6 months, I didn't go anywhere near a course. And I'm sure that happens to so many people.
Same here. Same here. I mean, when I got promoted to manager, it was a little bit out of the blue because of someone had stepped away. And so it's like you get a phone call, you're it. And the next day you lead a team. And I have to assume that still happens.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. So let's talk a little bit about your leadership style. What was your path to leadership? And as you became more comfortable in the leadership role, mm-hmm. how did you lead?
I had never set out per se to become a leader. I'm also not going to say that it just happened, because sometimes you get an opportunity and you respond to it, and someone sees something in you and gives you a chance. And so over time, you slowly move into higher positions. I think what I would like to say about my management style is I like to be clear and try to create an environment where people work together, but also where the number of surprises is very low. And I like it to be predictable. Not that there cannot be any change, but as you can imagine, when you work in HR and payroll, and especially when I was leading a payroll service center, you don't want to have any surprises. You have them all the time, obviously, because it's an operational business. But you really want to stabilize that business and bring it down to, you know, to running as smoothly as you can, because that means that the customers have great service. In other roles that I've had, for instance, when I started to lead strategy and alliances, you're a lot less about stability. And so you're a lot more about constant change and what are the new things? How can we adapt? What do we need to bring in? And making sure that the people around you are aware of where you are at, what you are negotiating, what you are thinking. And then suddenly, and that whole relationship that you have with leaders at the same level doing other things becomes a whole different thing. So I would say that throughout my leadership journey, the way that I have led has also been situational, just because of these different positions and the requirements that were there.
Yeah, and I should imagine that role of strategy and alliances probably shaped a lot of what you do now, because now mm-hmm. as a thought leader and a future of work expert, you're always scanning the horizon for the trends, aren't you?
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, this was the strategy and alliances role was something that was right up my alley, that I enjoy doing very much, simply because what I like to do most is think about the future and think about, you know, the technologies ahead, the changes ahead, what does that mean? And then help HR and payroll professionals to really think about the practical side. How can we make this happen? What can we do today to get there? And I would almost say, like, translate these difficult concepts for them so it's applicable today, and they don't have to look at it as, yeah, maybe in 5 years we will do this. No, you need to start preparing today. You need to do this today, and that will get you one step closer. I think people often look at these big shiny objects and then they become a little bit miserable because they're trying to embrace it, but they're doing too much in one go. And when you break it down in sizable portions, then you can get there too, maybe 6 months later, but at least in a way that is manageable for your business and also sustainable for your business. Because when you implement change or when you're after change, it must be sustainable. Otherwise, you're doing this thing this month and that thing this next month, and nothing will help you because it's all short projects and they won't stick.
Yeah, and I should imagine that that's the value that your books bring as well, is also like how to break it down into manageable chunks, how to make it sustainable. And I think you've said that you're onto the second edition of your payroll book, or that your payroll book was a huge bestseller, which came as a bit of a surprise to you.
Exactly, because I was like, so at that point when I wrote the book, I was like, okay, I've had enough of payroll. Don't want to do it for a while. But before I leave, I'll just write down everything that I know, and then people can help themselves. Okay. And I thought, well, I have no idea how many books I will sell, but if I sell like 50 or 100, I had read somewhere that most people never sell more than 200 books. So the 200 books was like a threshold. I thought, well, okay, maybe 200 books. Well, after 1 or 2 months, I had already sold 200 books. So I went much quicker than I had imagined. And the book is still selling well. And so last year, I thought, with all the changes that have happened, especially now in payroll, which was quite unexpected, but a lot of technology movements came together and therefore changed payroll fundamentally. So I better write a second edition, which I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I must just say for our listeners that the first time I met Anita was in, I think, October 2022.
In Paris,
at an HR Tech conference. Mm-hmm. Your book had just come out. And I was saying to you then, oh, maybe I'll write a comms book. I'm not sure. Anita was very much my role model in the book publishing world. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Every time that I talk to an aspiring author, I always encourage them to just go and do it, because if that is something that you want, why not try? I mean, if it doesn't work out, okay, but at least you've tried. And in this case, it did work out, which I'm so happy for you. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Anita. And you've given me a lot of support in the background, so mm-hmm. thank you for that. Just a little bit of a shift now. As a thought leader, as somebody who's written their own books, as you speak on keynote stages all the time, you've got a fantastic reputation. How do you think about your own reputation?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I do not think about my reputation a lot, but I am careful with it, in the sense that I try to be a little bit provocative on social media, for instance, to make people think. But I also want to be a little bit careful, in the sense that I'm not going to talk about politics or any other topic that I know nothing about, simply because I think people appreciate me because I talk about HR and I talk about payroll. And if I now suddenly start talking about music or something, then I don't know if people would like that. And secondly, I like to speak about things that I know a lot about. So you won't hear me speak about music or politics or whatever. I think that reputation is one of the most important assets that you have as a thought leader and a speaker. And it would be very foolish to throw all of that going to say goodwill and reputation away just because you want to blurb something out there. It's not me.
Yeah, I can see that very much from, you know, from following you on LinkedIn and subscribing to your newsletter, that you are controversial, but within your realm of expertise, which works very well.
And look, I have tried, sometimes there's something that interests me and I think, maybe my readers would be interested as well. But then I've noticed that if it's not about the topics that I speak a lot about, that goes flat. No one likes it. No one responds or comments to it. So then it's like almost like, yeah, why should I take the time to do that? This is what people expect from me. Let me give that to them. And there are, you know, within HR and payroll and then also pay transparency and those topics, there's so much to say that I don't really need to venture out in other into other areas. But maybe I will. I don't know. In future.
You're unlikely to run out of subject matter, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Anita, so my book, We Need New Leaders, sits at the intersection of diversity, reputation, and leadership.
Yeah.
And my passion is we have an old leadership archetype. We tend to recognize something that's loud and something that's big as leadership, whereas that might just be overconfidence. And my passion is to recognize new ways of leading. What do you think we can do collectively, but also individually, to change that archetype of leadership and celebrate new ways of leading?
Well, first of all, I think we should change our leadership expectations because it all starts with us. We have for a very long time celebrated, like you mentioned, a certain type of leadership, and we don't even know if that leadership is effective, if it's sustainable. And I think that as we see more diverse leaders come to the stage, we start to understand that there is not one way. And we are pushed a little bit into that direction because, you know, very successful leaders are celebrated everywhere. They're on the front page of magazines. They write books. When you are successful with a certain style at one company, that does not mean that you can copy paste that into another company and be successful. So we should not overlook the fact that these leaders are so successful in that particular situation, not because of themselves, but because of the people around them and the people under them that, you know, collectively elevated this person because something resonated in the way that he or she led them at that particular time.
That's such an interesting insight, and no one said that yet, that leaders are successful in environments because of the people around them. We always celebrate the great individualist, the amazing talent, the charismatic leader, the wonderful speaker, without ever recognizing that it's phalanxes of people who've put them there through. And I know this from writing keynotes at 4 a.m. because the leader sent me changes at 2 a.m. You know, all those people who are kind of almost conspiring, but working together in a way to make sure that one person looks successful. That's such an interesting insight.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So we now get to the questions I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
I read this wonderful book. It's called The Magician. It's by Tobin Colm, if I pronounce that correctly. It's an Irish name. It's a book about Thomas Mann. As you know, he was born in Germany, lived a very interesting life, moved to the United States, had interesting relationships with his children, I would say, and also lived in a super interesting time, obviously, start of the 20th century and then through the war and everything. So I bought it in, I was in London, I saw it and I bought it. And I read it last summer. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I can fully endorse The Magician. I have read it too. It's an absolutely beautiful book. It's a masterpiece of literary imagination.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was really sad when I turned the last page over that it was done.
That's always a sign of a very good book, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anita, what are your 3 tips for emerging leaders from diverse backgrounds? These are the leaders who have ambition to lead. They want to either land their dream leadership role. They want to stay in it, because landing it and staying it is not always the same thing. Or they want to create it for themselves. What tips do you have?
I would say you want to run, but you need to walk first. And I think that everyone wants to aspire, or a lot of people aspire to be a leader, but in order to be a good leader, you need to go through a number of challenging situations. You need to work with a couple of challenging people. And if you take the time for those experiences, that will help you later in life. Second thing is, especially when it comes to leaders from a diverse background, do not be afraid. Speak up. No one is going to ask you anything. You have to do it yourself. And especially when you come to a certain level, people will not give you a turn to speak, because everyone wants to speak first. And that means that you really need to carve out a place for yourself, and you need to speak up about what you find important. Does not mean that you need to speak up all the time, but make sure that when you speak up, it is critically important and people notice. And then third, I know that once you get to a position of leadership, it is very easy to immerse yourself into this position 24/7. And so that means that you need to very deliberately carve out time for yourself to recuperate, to recharge, but also to do something else. So don't all, when you have free time, only read business books. Read a novel for pleasure. Don't only go to work conferences. Do something else. Take a course. And I know that time is precious when you get into a position of leadership, but if you do not find time to recuperate and recharge, you will not be in a position of leadership for a very long time.
Those are 3 lovely tips, and I'm just going to repeat them back. So the first was, don't rush walk, because the process of walking will give you difficult experiences through which you acquire wisdom that will help you on your journey. The second was speak up when it makes sense for you to speak up. Have your voice and gain a reputation for speaking up on certain things that are meaningful to you. And the other was take breaks and or boundaries. Yes. So be a whole person. Don't just be 100% committed or married to the business.
Exactly. There's this one saying that I have always taken or used in the back of my mind. You love the job, but the job doesn't love you back. And if you keep that, like I said, in the back of your mind, it allows you to sometimes take a step back and, you know, look at this with a little bit of distance. Because especially when you are in a leadership position, there are no guarantees. And often what it means when you are in a leadership position is that tomorrow someone can come in and say, well, it's done. Huh? Thank you for your service, but this was it. And so that means that you need to have a person, or be a person, have a personality outside of work, so that when that day comes, I'm not saying it that it will, but it might, that you don't like fall into this black hole because work was all you knew and work was all you are, or Does that make sense?
It makes beautiful sense. And that leads me beautifully into my last question, which is, in the name of being a whole person and having interests outside of work, what brings you joy?
I love to run, and you know that. Especially when I travel, I always try to figure out an interesting route that I can run, where I can see some of the sights, or maybe run across the shore or something, but really just be and enjoy and feel your body. And I always have the best ideas when I run, simply because for the first 10, 15, 20 minutes, you're just busy with, oh, it's not going so well and I should run faster. And then after 20 minutes, that all falls away and you get into the zone, and then the most magical things happen in my mind. So that.
Oh, that's so lovely. Anita Letting, thank you so much for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.